The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 85. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
I had an interview earlier today with a buddy of mine from YouTube. His YouTube handle is The Uneducated Economist. And
I just came across him, one of our clients, a gentleman in Sweden sent me a video of his. He's talking about lumber.
Yeah, that he works in a lumber yard.
Yeah.
So you'll find the conversation I had with him probably pretty interesting. That'll go up next week. But he's a good buddy of mine. And I really like to get his take because he can see like the housing market from in the trenches. When we're talking about inflation, deflation, it's not just this pie in the sky macro stuff. He's there ringing people up as they're buying lumber or paint or whatever. And he's also the purchasing manager for the store. So he talks to the suppliers, whether they're in Canada or the people in the lumber mills. And so it's a really fascinating take on what's going on. But he said that initially, when the U.S. went into kind of lockdown mode, call it the beginning of March, the guy that owns the lumber yard, because it's not like a Home Depot, it's like a ma and pa kind of competitor, right. Came and said, well, you know, we might have to lay some people off and we might have to reduce hours. And they were kind of getting prepared for that. And then he said, all of a sudden, about 3 or 4 weeks later, when people started to get their stimulus checks from the government, he said business just started booming and they had to actually bring on more people to manage all of the business they were doing, especially on the weekends, because what happened is people were required to stay home. Meanwhile, a lot of people that really didn't need the money got the money or making more money than they were at their jobs because of the unemployment benefits plus the additional $600 a month or a week or whatever it was. And he said that what they're doing is they're just coming in to remodel their houses. They didn't have anything else better to do. So they're coming in and buying paint and buying lumber to build a new deck to barbecue or paint to repaint their kids' room or something like that. Yeah. And so initially he saw the prices of like 2x4s we were talking about go down pretty substantially. But recently he's seen prices really shoot up. And I saw the same thing in a video I did where we were talking about flights from Miami to LA. And looking back February, or let's call it January, they were $350 a flight. And when we kind of went full force with the virus, the prices just plummeted, went down to like $100 a flight. But then what happened is all the airlines just started to park their planes on the runway and just take them out of service. So you had the supply actually go down faster than the demand. And now if you look at a price,
everything's more expensive.
It's more expensive than it was back in January, but there's just a lot fewer flights. And my buddy, the Uneducated Economist, saw the exact same thing playing out in his lumberyard.
Well, what I'm seeing happening, George, and it's not just in the airline industry or in the lumber industry or any of these things. If you think about a typical sort of recessionary type of period, let's say you're a large manufacturer of whatever it is, and you go through a mild recession, typically what you're going to do is just you will take the hit and you won't necessarily lay off and furlough staff. You might get, you know, you wouldn't have capital expansion. So you're not going to open a new store or, you know, and you might not take that holiday that you, you know, had planned for your wife and so on and so forth. So you kind of hunker down for that period of time. But what you don't normally do is decimate your own supply chains. You don't, you know, if you've got trucks that are running, let's say we're transporting goods and services or goods around the country. We don't sell our trucks, right? We might not be moving as much goods, but we typically don't sell those capital goods because we know, oh, well, it's like a recession probably in 6-12 months' time. you know, it'll start picking up again. Maybe it might take 12, you know, maybe it takes a year and a half or something. But, you know, you kind of foresee that, and you hunker down and you nut on with it. What we're seeing in this instance is that the demand destruction has been so intense that your inability to just service anything that you have is massively curtailed. And it's not like you had revenue just being paid back. In certain instances, they went to zero. You know, if you were in the airline industry, it almost went to zero because you just couldn't do anything. And certainly in the tourism industry, you know, if you had to shut up your shop and you were running a bar, you know, bars are all closed, right? So if you're running a bar, you just had to actually go about destroying that infrastructure and supply. You'd get rid of all your bar staff, you get rid of your waiters, you get rid of all of the you know, many of those things. And so when, you know, so what you have then now is when any sort of coming out of that takes place, there's kind of nothing left. It's like just you're surveying this wasteland, which is very, very different to any previous recession. And I kind of feel like a lot of finance folks are looking in the rearview mirror, looking at previous recessionary periods, and then saying, okay, well, how did those play out? And that's a logical way to go about thinking about things. But it's not the same. It's really not, because in any previous, the psychology has been very, very different because of the necessity to literally decimate your supply of goods and services, which we've never had before. And so that, you know, yes, there's the demand side of things, which has collapsed for this period of time. But the supply side, because we've never had supply destruction like that before. It's always been that mental thing of, oh, we're going through a rough period. We're going to like pull back. We might not have CapEx spending it to the same level, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we might... If you're an airline industry, you might have run less flights, right? Let's say you're doing 5 a week, maybe you go to 3 a week, something like that, but you don't sell your airplane. And in this instance, we've had kind of the opposite, not the opposite, but we've just had it at a much, much greater level. And so that supply side has been absolutely decimated in certain sectors more than others. But I think that's, you know, to what you're talking about with the airlines, that's the case. And then the fact is, the what we've had, and this is really why I wanted to talk to you about, is, you know, this whole globalization that took place kind of post Bretton Woods was one of increasing that pie. And it's a scale of economy, right? It's just a matter of scale of economies. You get better services, the cost of those services and products goes down because you have more participants. You know, anyone understands economics 101. If you have more buyers in a room to buy, you know, this pen, right? Pen's going to go for more money. But if I add more pens and I add more people, the whole cost of everything goes down because the ability to make the pen becomes cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Because you have more participants, and like you and I might go, oh, we'll make a pen cheaper than that joker over there. And so you have a lot of competition comes in. That expansion of the pie has been one that we've been experiencing kind of post Bretton Woods, and it's been disinflationary in goods, many, many goods and services. And what we're seeing now is very much a different environment, whereby many of those producers of goods and services have gone away, and you come out with something whereby those scale of economies are not what they used to be. So to your point of flights, there's that many, the cost of the airplane is still the cost of the airplane.
Yeah, right.
And so if you don't fill it, so let's say there's 300 seats on the plane,
yeah,
and you can't fill 300 seats, right? And you can't run that plane literally backwards and forwards all day long. You can only run it 50% of the time. You have to charge like 50% more just to get you to break even. So you have this this inflation that comes through as a consequence of a relative lack of supply relative to, you know, the demand. And we're seeing this in foodstuffs, and we're seeing it in travel, and we're seeing it in, we're going to see it in energy.
Before we get into energy, because I really want to take a deep dive on that, I want to run something by you really quick. I've been trying to think through it. I've actually, just for the viewers out there, if you ever see me do a video on something, a lot of times the only reason I'm doing that video is because I'm trying to think through it myself. And just doing a whiteboard video kind of helps me do that.
Yeah.
But
it's actually a great way to, I mean, that's one of the reasons I started writing.
Yeah, it does, especially when I'm drawing things up on a whiteboard. And a lot of people comment and say, oh, you must have a big staff that does all your research and does, but actually, believe it or not, I do all that and I draw this stuff up on the whiteboard myself. But my point is, I went back to look at inflation and deflation in the United States since, I think I went back, I found a chart to like, it was the 1800s. Yeah. And I think it might have been 1800. And what you see from 1800, call it, to the middle of the 1930s is you just see inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation. It just back and forth to where from 1800 to 1900, prices actually went down over that 100-year period. And even, I think, if you would have taken it out from 1800 to, call it 1930, or especially with 1931, 32, prices would have gone down for the whole span of the 100 and, call it 30 years. Then what happened in the mid-1930s is instead of just seeing inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation, you pretty much just saw inflation, 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 inflation. Every once in a while, you just see a tick down, just a little tick down like we got in like 2008, or we had it, I think, in the 1950s, just briefly. But other than that, it's pretty much inflation the whole way through. So I had a discussion with Jim Rogers the other day, and I was trying to get his framework and really understand it because he's my favorite investor. And he said what he used to do in his classes in Columbia is he'd have his students look at a chart going as far back as they could, whether it was the price of cotton, commodities, stocks, whatever. And they'd look for an anomaly in the chart and try to ask themselves, okay, what created this? So I was looking at this chart and I saw that in the beginning of the 1930s, yes, we had substantial deflation in prices. But what was surprising is after about 1934 to 1940, we actually had pretty substantial inflation in the United States. So most people think the 1930s, oh, it was this massive depression and prices just kept going down further, which led to more unemployment and more destruction of credit and money supply and all these things. It's actually not true. So my point is, okay, what happened in 1934 or in the late 1930s? And I'm not saying, I'm not trying to say causation is, or correlation is causation, right, anything like that. But it is interesting that in 1934 or 1935, they passed the act which brought us unemployment benefits and Social Security. Then in the, call it 1938 or so, they came in with the minimum wage. And so I thought, wait a minute here. Okay, so now all of a sudden, when we go into a recession, the people out on the street, I'm not saying this is good or bad, but they now have money in their pocket where they otherwise wouldn't have had that. And there's a transfer mechanism for the government to take debt and get it into the back pocket of the average Joe and Jane. And you combine that with the minimum wage. So thinking back through what we just were discussing with the airlines, as an example, when they first get that demand shock, they can say, okay, well, we'll put some air, you know, some planes on the runway, we'll run fewer flights, we'll do all these things. But if there wasn't a minimum wage, especially going through the entire supply chain of the country, they could lower wages. And if they lower wages, then they wouldn't necessarily have to decrease supply as fast as they otherwise would have. And I thought, well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's why we haven't seen inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation. And I'd love to get your thoughts on
as the short answer in my way of thinking is actually, you know, we as humans like to try and think, make things black and white. And we go, okay, like, is it going to be inflationary? Is it going to be deflationary? And I used to think about that when I was sort of 20, because you want a fairly simplistic view of the world. And the problem with that is that the economy and the you know, finance and everything that we're talking about here is this giant ecosystem. And it all interacts in various shapes and forms. And there is, you know, that comment that you made about, you know, correlation is not necessarily causation is really, really true. So there are many, many factors that can contribute to a certain outcome. It's not just a one thing causes another thing necessarily. There are, it could have, if I pushed against you, you know, that's a force. And I could say, well, that's going to make you fall over. But if at the same time you're bracing for that, then there's another force. Then if you've got something behind you that I can't even see, you've got another force. And so, you know, and then I might have slippery shoes. And like, there's a, you know what I mean? There's a lot of different things that can come in that can affect. My pushing is probably the major one. My slippery shoes is lesser of a thing. But then the floor might be extra slippery, or it could be really have a lot of traction, you know? So there's a lot of different elements that you could add to any one little picture, if you will. And the economy is like that. And each service sector, product sectors are all like that. And so there are where you bring in minimum wage and where you bring in subsidies, tariffs, all these sorts of things, they have an impact. And so it just, I guess the answer is it makes it very difficult to actually ascertain that. And one of the things that I have spent over the years more time on than I would have in my younger days is trying to look at major trends that are taking place at a, so I guess, a societal type of level, mm-hmm. right? In other words, what is society moving towards? What are the prevailing narratives? What are the prevailing attitudes of that society? Because those attitudes and those narratives typically drive the responses, whether they be you know, economic in terms of how people allocate their capital, but certainly in terms of how governments, you know, choose to, quote unquote, manage any particular situation or any industry. In at least certainly in the democratic world, that has been the case, right? Because you could, if you come out with all sorts of policies that you, people that hurt people and they don't like it and so on and so forth, the odds are you're going to get voted out of power and so on and so forth. So there is a dynamic there. And in that space, when I'm looking at what's taking place now, and this was really one of the things that I wanted to talk about today, because we could talk about all the finance stuff and what the Fed's doing and what the ECB are doing and all these sorts of things. They're all important. What I think, and again, this is, I've been spending the last good few weeks or months on, is trying to make sure that I've got the right picture, or at least sufficient amount of the right picture on a longer term basis going forward, because I think it's really going to be critical. If you just think about what our lives look like, you know, a few months ago, we were in a completely different situation. And right. Here we are, we're locked down. We can like hardly move, right? We can't even necessarily, depending on where we are, who we are, where we're living, we can't even get on an aeroplane and go somewhere else. We go, fuck it, I've had enough of this, I want to go somewhere else. We can't even do that. And you could be a, you know, phenomenally wealthy person, you still can't do it. That should be, I think, a big wake-up call and a shock. And it has been something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. If you go back, so here's how I'm thinking about it, George. Okay, so where have we come from? We've come from this world where we had this massive globalization trend, okay? If you look at the various globalizations if that's even a word that we've had, sort of the 15th to the 18th century. At that point of time, it was kind of raw materials, basic goods that were being traded. And on an international basis, exports as a percentage of GDP, global exports, were somewhere around 5% or less.
What time is that, Chris?
15th, sort of 15th to the 18th century.
Okay.
Then you go the 19th century through to kind of 1914. We all know what happened then. That had grown. That was, you know, an additional globalization. That was most like things like textiles, industrial goods were exported and imported all around the world. And exports as a percentage of global GDP went to around about 14, up a high of 14%. So from 5%, that was a phenomenal period of time. Obviously, this was over a long right. period of time. It was in the 19th century. Then if we go from, things took a dive, 1914, but from go sort of 1945 through to kind of 1990, which was more the period of time that most people can kind of conceive of.
Going back to Bretton Woods.
There was that industrial sort of output, and it was factories, you know, factory production, things like that. And we ramped right up to like 15% of, global exports, around 15%. Then the period that really, you know, makes sense to us because of our ages was sort of 1989, 1990 period of time through to, I'll call it 2008. And that really was this global supply chain that we had. That was the Bretton Woods period, okay? Right. And that really amped things up. It had all of these partners that came into that global marketplace. Near the tail end of it, it became all of the Asian groups. It became China. A lot of that was disinflationary, because we were bringing in so many low-cost labor into that workforce, but it brought goods and services that made our lives wonderful, you know, and everybody, or many people, could afford them. Now, there's a financial side behind all of that, and who was, you know, basically we know that the trade balances in the West have gone negative during that period of time. But that in that period, we ramped up to the point now where we have, you know, trade, global trade today is roughly 46%
of global GDP.
Of global GDP, and that's what, an $86 trillion global economy. So this has been a phenomenal expansion. So you think about that. Then think about, and look, with that, there was things like NAFTA, which is the largest free trade agreement in the world. It was all the various trade agreements, even within Asian countries, within European countries. You know, within that period of time, we saw the EU come into play. So again, this massive sort of expansion of the pie. Now, I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's not my job here. The point is it happened, and there were positive and negatives to it. One of those things that is critical to understand is that it was severely disinflationary. It has been also one of the key drivers behind the offshoring of, you're an American, certainly American jobs, but Western jobs, all right, to Vietnam, Bangladesh, China, et cetera, et cetera. And in return, we got, you know, super cheap consumer goods. What's interesting, because if you look, you were talking about inflation and deflation, if you look at the goods and services that you could not offshore, things like healthcare, education, those have been severely inflationary,
right?
And then if we look at cell phones and t-shirts and software and, you know, manufactured goods, they've all been super deflationary. And so when you look at that context, you can understand why that is. So I think it's just important to kind of, I try not to get caught up in that, oh, is it deflation, inflation, and everybody's yelling at each other. You go on Twitter, everyone's yelling at each other. And it's just, it's a fucking mess. But just stop and look and say, okay, well, what are some of these drivers? And then look at some of these individual goods and services. You know, why is it that healthcare is more expensive? Why is it that higher education is more expensive? Why is it that childcare is more expensive? And why is it that your cell phone is cheaper? You know, so and they're easy questions to answer when you just bring them down to an individual level, right? Mm. What's interesting now, and by the way, that also created a lot of inequality, mm. Which, you know, I remember writing an article probably about 2 years ago where I was mentioning why we were likely to start getting more populism in the world, and why it was, like I pointed to Trump, just many I could have pointed to, but he was one, and I said, this is why he's going to win. And at the time, you know, I think he had like a 5% chance of winning or something according to the polls and stuff. But if you kind of looked at a lot of these forces that were taking place and you looked at who was impacted and negatively and positively, you could kind of see, and look, Brexit was the same thing, or had elements of the same components that were creating those social issues, if you will. What we got now is the kind of tail end of that, it feels like. And that expansionary process was already coming under pressure before we went into this virus scenario, right? We saw that with trade agreements coming under pressure. We saw it with the US pulling back from NATO, from a lot of these trade agreements where they're saying, hang on a second, this isn't working for us anymore. And I don't want to get too deep into why that is, but, you know, we've written about it plenty. But that was already in place. But what this has brought about is an accelerant to that, right, at super large scale, where there's this questioning of do those relationships still work for us? And if so, how? And that's going to become an ever greater problem, given that people are going to be in our work and looking for a solution. Mentally, it's a retrenchment. If you think about what people are doing when they've either lost their job or the incomes are being impaired, you pull back, right? So mentally, there's a whole pullback, and it's not just in terms of individuals, it's in terms of countries, it's in terms of societies that are retrenching from that, hey, let's make this pie bigger. On a political basis, what that, if we look at history, what that typically engenders is how do we divide the pie is the question, not how do we expand the pie. How do we expand the pie is a capitalist view. How do we divide the pie is largely a socialist or communist view, right? And that's what concerns me more than anything else. And so when I look at it in that sort of light, that the siren call of socialism is a very strong one. Even if you sort of fundamentally know that it doesn't or hasn't worked before, if you've lost your job and you've got to feed yourself and somebody's going to come and give you something or promise to give you something, it's a very powerful call. And so coupled with that, there's this almost like threat of clan where, and we're seeing it on like sort of with racism. I mean, a buddy of mine sent me through something in the States where particular states are shutting their borders to other states, you know, to stop the virus. It's like, oh no, you're from a different state. You can't enter here. That's tribal. It's absolutely tribal in nature, right? And that's happening globally. Think about it. Countries have shut their borders to other countries. You're out. We're New Zealanders. We're Americans. We're Singaporeans, whatever it is. Everybody else out. It's a completely tribal reaction. It's clan. It's looking after the clan. And even within communities, it's the same thing is taking place. Like I said, in the States, you've got particular communities where they're like, oh, you can't enter here, you know? And you could go, I'm an American, I'm like you, and they're like, fuck off. So it's interesting to evaluate what that means on a much more global scale, and then what are the reactions to it. What's troubling is that in that environment there is an overly large chance or an overly large probability that you get authoritarian type of rule. It is the very, very environment that allows for that to take place. And there was a fantastic podcast I listened to the other day with one of the ruling lawmakers in the House of Lords in the UK, Lord Sumption, I believe his name is. And he talks about how dangerous what is taking place is because you've got a police state coming into power. And he talks about police states and authoritarian setups typically take place not because of some overwhelming enemy that comes in and rules over another,
No, it's bottoms up.
It's bottoms up. It's people literally give up their rights under some context of fear. When you drive enough fear into their hearts, they just willingly give up their rights. And he's laying it out. He does a brilliant job of it. And
security
so,
over freedom.
Yeah, exactly. When I look at some of the, if you will, the problems on a social basis, okay, so we know there's financial problems, and look, everybody's got them. You know, right now we're bullish dollars. On the emerging market side of things, that's because of the shortage of dollars out there. But on a social, if you think about a social construct in various countries, in largely in the West, let's talk about the US. I know a lot of your viewers are American-based, and what is happening in the US to a certain extent is quite similar to that which is taking place in Europe and other Western, call it democratic countries. Massive pension problems. The funding for these pensions are wholly inadequate. I think Medicare and Medicaid is about $70 trillion underfunded. It's not possible to pay that back. The solution that they have used and that they're continuing to use is it's not the solution for pensions, but what they are doing is they're marking around with the cost of capital. And so, you can't screw with the cost of capital because that affects every single asset class on the planet. And so, but that's what they're doing, and they're going to continue to do that. So it means that pensions, for example, are just not going to be resolved. And then how do you resolve them? Well, you could bail them out, like a literal massive, massive sort of bailout. And that's probable at some level. When I'm looking what's going on in the States at the moment, a lot of the particular states are going bankrupt and looking for bailouts. I suspect it's likely that they're going to look for a big enough bailout to be able to cover their pension schemes, right, even though they fucked them up for years, and they'll turn around and they'll blame it on the virus when that's not at all what the problem was.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page.
It's actually a great excuse for them.
It's a fantastic, it's like,
yeah, just defer blame from the politicians on the virus.
Yeah, and people will be too dumb and stupid to even like go, oh, well, hang on a second. You were massively underfunded before you went into this thing. So, and so a lot of that really actually just drives us towards what we believe is going to take place, which is stagflation. And that's fine. We're positioned for that. But what's taking place at the same time is that that society is being destroyed as a consequence of these actions that are taken. For example, think about the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, you had some bureaucrat in the Kremlin who decided how much wheat got grown, where, by whom, and so on and so forth. They decided who got a motor car, who was important enough to get a motor car, how long they, you know, and all of those you know, goods and services that would normally move around an economy were just massively halted. And what did you have? We didn't have deflation. There's no deflation there. It was just massively expensive cost of goods. To get a car was fucking expensive as hell. No one could afford a car. It was only the bureaucrats. No one could afford food. You ate what you could, and the cost of it was extremely, extraordinarily high. Think about what's happening.
Are the prices stable, though, Chris? I see. I've never researched a communist country, their economy. How does that work? Because they control everything. Well, so are prices gradually going up, or they're just always high?
That's where you get two markets. So they had set prices, you know, of a bushel of wheat would be, you know, so many ruble.
Right.
But there was no availability of the bushel of wheat.
A black market.
Right. So you're like, oh, well, wheat's cheap. You know, everybody can afford wheat, but you go to the store and there's any fucking wheat. And so the only way you could get to wheat was to find out who bloody had it. And then they weren't going to take that price. So you had to pay them five times the price. So you have the black market. So in real terms, you had massive inflation. To get anything was very expensive. And think about it today. The governments of the world, and this is mind-boggling to me, because it's not isolated, have largely said who is essential, quote-unquote, and who's not. So if you and I were running a supermarket chain, whoopee, we're essential. On the other hand, if we were running a butcher store, we're not essential. We're shut down. Think about that. So now the butcher doesn't have any ability to sell his meat. The supply, if you move down that supply chain, the farmers that supply anybody other than the supermarkets have lost their business. There are farmers going out of business right now. When you think, hang on a second, everybody still needs food, doesn't matter. They were not designated, or the part of the supply chain was not designated to be essential. And so they're not essential. And so they're pouring milk down the drain, and they're slaughtering the herds, and they're plowing their food back into the ground. I'm just using agriculture as an example.
Yeah, meanwhile, prices are going up.
Yeah, so it's supply destruction, right? Then think about retail. If you and I had a retail store in, I don't know, Ohio, we're selling shirts, we're stuffed, we had to shut down. I'm choosing, I don't actually know if Ohio is shut down, but there's many, many, stores throughout the States and anywhere around the world, frankly, which have been forced to close down. And yet Amazon's not. Amazon's set up for this. So who benefits? Who captures like 100% of that market? Amazon. Who captures? You used to run an events service, right? Or an events company. So if you and I were doing that now, we're screwed because we can't run an events company. However, Zoom can, right? Zoom is now actually an events company, largely, because people are running events on Zoom. So you have this massive distortions that are taking place because government decree has said, you're essential, you're not essential. And so that creates more inequality in the society, even more than we had going in. And we had a lot going in because of, lobbyist groups and all this sort of kleptocracy that we've had. Now, what I've been looking at is kind of pulling back and saying, okay, what's happening in the world? What are these social constructs that we're dealing with? Who's doing what and why, and how are they dealing with this pandemic, and how are they likely to deal with it on a go-forward basis? Because I think that gives us a playground or a playing field to understand longer term who are likely to be the winners and who are likely to be the relative losers. And when I look at what's taking place there, it's phenomenal. It's very much a West-East type of structure. In the West, we have these increasingly socialist governments. They're talking about UBI, universal basic income, for your listeners if they're not sure what UBI is. And very much you're essential, you're not essential. You're essential, you're not essential. So, you know, and then they're tackling the crisis with handouts, which is increasing their debt load. And that means that you have an increasing percentage of the population that is now dependent upon the government. And not only do they necessarily think that that's how it should be, or not only, they're asking for more of it. I mean, there's a report out, I'm sure you probably came across it, where many of the people who are now on government-subsidized wage programs don't want to go back to work because they're earning more money from the government than if they were going to go back to work. So we're paying...
Yeah, then they get pissed off at their employer if their employer does bring them back because it's a pay decrease.
Yeah. So when you think about, you know, I was trying to explain this to my son. What is money? Money is a unit of productivity. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you add units without any productivity, the mechanism breaks down. Right? And so what we're doing largely in the West is we're adding units of productivity with no productivity. In fact, we're paying people not to be productive. How do you get yourself out of a debt situation? Productivity and paying down the debt. That's how you get yourself out of a debt debacle. So not only did we go into this with a debt debacle, we're accelerating that like we've never done before. Just obscenely so. And not only that, people are championing it. People are cheering for it. And what they're cheering for is more authoritarianism. Because when... It's been a long time since I've been an employee. Very, very long time. But I do recall having to do what my boss told me to do. Because I knew if I didn't, I'm out of fresh out of luck. That's part of the equation. Are you going to turn around and tell your government not to do something when you're reliant on them, when you're wholly reliant on them? That whole, you know, ability to look after yourself is just being shattered. That's very psychologically, that is very, very bad for any society. So you've got this debt-laden economy. That really can only do a few things. It can just remain moribund. We've also got more and larger monopolies, your Amazon, your Google, your Netflix, a lot of anything that's on the tech base. And in fact, we can see this in the S&P. So if you just look at the S&P at the moment, your top five companies, you've got Facebook, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Nvidia. I was looking at it last night. Their market caps have all just hit fresh highs at about $6 trillion. That's equal to combined GDP of Germany and Italy. We're having this extraordinary wealth distribution taking place. Like, unbelievable. Okay? And the losers, the people who can't participate in that, because look, most people are not fucking shareholders of Microsoft or Amazon, or they're just trying to, you know, run their barbershop or... you know, do whatever it is that they do. Maybe they're plumbers, maybe they're, you know, salesmen for roof tiles, I don't know, but like, they're not participating in this. And they've been shut down, they've been told that they're no longer useful, and they're now reliant on the government. That's all very much a recipe for authoritarianism. The other thing, in terms of structurally trying to get these countries out of this setup, financially, again, productivity is being destroyed. In order to correct this, like in a normal recession, you have businesses going out of bust and you have creative destruction, right? Maybe they've got factory, plant, machinery. Somebody goes and picks it up, right? Some business goes bust. You and I come in and go, oh, man, wow, we can get, you know, a bunch of... diggers for half price. Why don't we start up a road construction company?
And allowing prices to go down. That's what allowing people forget prices, to go prices down. Going down are the cure for a recession, because that's what creates the fundamental demand.
And within the prices going down, one of those prices is labor costs. You have to let labor costs set at the market. And that's what the West is not going to do. That's why we've got UBI coming through, right? Yeah. And minimum wage policies and all of this. So that's fixed. It's rigid. What you get there is the public sector crowds out the private. Because you and I, trying to run a business, we go, oh, wow, we can get these diggers for half price. And we need to get people to drive them. Oh, in fact, we've got to pay them how much per hour? And you do the numbers, you're like, God damn, we can't, you know?
One more thing I want to mention that to layer on top of your point is now we have a situation where these smaller businesses, not the Amazons and the Googles of the world, but they're asking themselves, okay, let's just say things open back up. We get rid of the lockdown, we're good to go. But now all of a sudden we have all these increased government regulations from a standpoint of health. So as an example, I've got a small restaurant. Now I need to put up plexiglass between all of the tables. Or now my insurance costs go from, call it $1,000 a month, my liability, up to $5,000 a month. Because if someone, let's say some 80-year-old person comes in and gets the virus and unfortunately passes, then the family, especially in the United States, it's so litigious. That family is going to go after the restaurant owner. The insurance companies know that. So then as a small business owner, you're thinking, okay, I'm going to have all these regulations come down on me from the government. I've got to make sure people are this far apart and I'm only allowing this many people in the bathroom at one time and maybe setting up a line outside of my restaurant and all of these things. When you add on the additional costs, then they're thinking to themselves, do I really want to do this? Or this just doesn't sound as good as it did.
George.
Yeah.
It's just more supply destruction. And you know, one of the things that we as humans do is we look in our recent rearview mirror to figure out what might transpire in the future. The last major problems that we have had in terms of inflation, it was demand-led growth. It was emerging market growth. So everybody's been looking, saying, okay, where's the growth going to come from? Oh, wow, the world's kind of turning to shit. Well, there's no growth, or therefore we can't have any inflation. But if you go back far enough and you look at enough history, you realize that inflation can come from supply destruction too. You know, and the oil embargo. There was plenty of oil around. There was fucking tons of oil around. And oil went through the roof. Why? It was the access to the oil that was impeded. It was, you know, so that was an access problem in terms of moving that oil. It wasn't necessarily that there was any deficiency in supply or deficiency in demand. So there's many things that can cause, and that has an inflationary impact throughout the economy, because energy is used in everything. You want to make bread, you need energy. You want to make, you know, so... so it's dangerous, coming back to what we talked about before. It's you know, the world is it's an ecosystem that has many, many moving parts. And I don't pretend to have all the answers, but it's important to try and understand and think about it like that. But coming back to where, well, you know, these things that are taking place in the West, when I look and I go, okay, well, what is happening elsewhere in the world? And I talk to people all over the world, like day in, day out, kind of probably like you, I guess. How are they tackling this? I'm broadly going to talk about the East, because, I mean, I could talk about varying countries, but broadly in the East, they're tackling it with hardship. You know, they're going, sucks, and you know, sort it out. Debts get written off. Markets clear. There is no minimum wage. So labor costs get readjusted to whatever the market is prepared to pay for those labor costs. That public-private sector structure has remained relatively the same. In the West, largely, that private public sector has changed dramatically, whereby the private sector is getting decimated and the public sector is just getting larger and taking on more liabilities. And people are cheering it, going, yeah, I need help. Help me out. That lack of pain that people are taking, where they now get a handout from the government, is going to create such pain in the future that they have no idea what how painful that can be. That's our working hypothesis. But in many of these other countries, you're getting the economic foundations for future growth. Right now, I'm not long those countries, but when as this plays out, I think it's important to watch what's taking place, because I do feel that the supply and demand, the labor costs, all those sorts of things are being, on a relative basis, are being left alone more so than in the Western democratic world. And that's going to allow, like, it's not government diktat that is determining one thing or the other to the same extent. So there's just less intervention. And then when you look at, when I look at the trade balances, I mean, I always spend a bunch of time looking at trade balances, because if you think about it as like a business, it's how much do you make, how much do you not make, really, you know. And it's phenomenal. I mean, across the Western world, you have massive, massive trade imbalances, whereby, you know, they're broke. They're all in the red.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.